everyone. It's good to be back with Marin Sangha. It's been quite a few months. I've been away personally from the Bay Area for about 6 weeks, came back in early October. And an interesting experience. I had planned and we had scheduled a retreat for October 14th and 15th. It was through Spirit Rock. It was an online retreat. And it was on the theme of bringing wisdom, empathy, and skillful speech to differences and conflicts. And little did I know what would occur on October 7th and thereafter. And it was a powerful weekend. I didn't focus that much on what was happening in Israel-Palestine, but we explored how to work with differences and conflicts as an extension, or as part, I should say, of our practice. And I wanted to share some of that with you. I've been really drawn to that. It's a topic I've been teaching in different ways for about 15 years. And it's been really important for me. It's often, I would say, a shadow territory in the meditation world. And I'll speak for what I know. In the insight meditation world, often there's not so much attention to conflict. You know, a lot of, as we know, a lot of the attention is particularly to individual formal meditation. And generally speaking, there's not so much attention even to daily life practice or bringing practice into different parts of our lives. Marin Sangha was founded in part to really have a strong emphasis on daily life practice. And most of you know that I've really had a very strong interest for probably 35 years in what we sometimes call socially engaged Buddhist practice. But it has been a shadow area, and I've seen in the insight meditation world conflicts not handled well, not very consciously. It's almost as if practice goes out the window. I remember Ram Dass once saying, in a talk, you know, when family stuff comes up, my practice goes out the window. And it may be in part because we haven't been very conscious about making the connections. And so I want to explore that. And what I've developed over, actually over the last month and a half or so, I've developed a framework and have identified 10 foundations for connecting our deepest practice with working with differences and conflicts. And I should say right from the beginning that the definition of conflict is really, really important, because many of us, probably the majority of us here, came through our childhood into conditioning that we might call conflict avoidance. I certainly did. How many can relate to that? How many had conditioning to be conflict avoidant? You know, it's, I think there also is conditioning to be conflict indulgent, where you just get into it, right? But when I've done surveys, it's been kind of 2/3 to 3/4 of people that in meditative circles are more conflict avoidant. And so very important to give the definition as conflict not necessarily involving hostility or aggression or, you know, really difficult interpersonal or other interactions. But conflict is simply the existence of some kind of difference in a view, in a goal, in a value, or a strategy. So I can, you know, and we almost have to do a little bit of inner work to redefine conflict so it's not negative. And maybe we even need a different word. Maybe I should just use the word difference, you know, and maybe that would be more helpful. But even if we use the word conflict, it could be a conflict. Okay, we're painting the house. Should I paint the house bright red or light blue? And I want it one way and my partner wants it the other way, right? And we could have that become something which involves some negativity, or we could take it as something that we could work with very constructively. What should I do this evening? Should I do this or that? Should I go to Marin Sangha? Or should I get a head start on my taxes? That may have been a big choice for many of us this evening. And some of the people you know who are not here may have chosen the second option. We don't know. But there could be a valid interest with either option. And so I want to reframe conflict as more the presence of a difference. And there can be small conflicts, there can be larger conflicts, there can be inner conflicts. Should I stay in this job or not? Should I, again, should I do this or do that this evening? We can have interpersonal differences or conflicts. We can have, of course, organizational conflicts. And of course, we can have social conflicts or larger conflicts. And they can be a test of our practice because sometimes when there are differences or conflicts, we have more reactivity, more difficult emotions. We have maybe more interpersonal challenges. I want to suggest that the dynamics of our practice are the same, whatever kind of difference there is, or whatever kind of conflict there is, that the core dynamics are the same, whether it's an inner conflict, should I stay in this relationship or not, or whether it's an interpersonal difference, or an organizational difference, or a larger conflict like what's happening now in Israel-Palestine. I want to say that the dynamics are the same and the way of practicing is the same. And we don't have that well developed a sense of how to practice. That's what I want to give tonight. And what I want to invite us to do right now is to think of some kind of difference or conflict that's on a more simple level for you, that's there right now. Take a few moments. It could be an inner conflict or an interpersonal conflict or maybe organizational. Think of one that is not too intense. Maybe on a scale of 1 to 10 is maybe a 5 or a 6, possibly a 7. So think of that right now, because what I'm going to invite us to do is to bring that personal difference or conflict with us as we explore what I'm going to call these 10 foundations. Now do that right now. Reflect, what's a personal conflict of a kind of moderate level that you have in your life right now? Could be an unresolved conflict in the family, maybe with siblings or whatever. Or maybe political differences with a good friend, where it's not overly intense. How many people have come up with something that you can keep? Yeah, I'll give a few more moments. See, because it can be really helpful if you think of something and have it as a reference point as we go through this. And I'm also going to invite us, if we so choose, to practice in the next week and explore how you work with differences, and maybe whether these 10 foundations for having it be an integral part of our spiritual practice, you know, maybe more of our daily life practice, whether this is something that we can deepen. Okay, so number one, foundation number one, not surprisingly, ground in the core teachings. Ground in the core teachings, particularly I'm thinking of a few teachings. One of them would be this favorite teaching of mine. Remember the two arrows. I have something difficult happen. We call that the first arrow. I have something painful happen. I will tend, if I'm not mindful, not observant, to shoot a second arrow, to be, in other words, reactive, to go into reactivity. And so we know when something painful or difficult happens, we may have strong tendencies to reactivity. We want to remember that. And when there's a difference or conflict, know that that's a tendency if it becomes unpleasant or painful. You know, that we may go into negativity towards another person or towards ourselves. We can remember the teaching that hatred only ends with non-hatred. Hatred never ends with hatred. So we need to have wisdom and compassion and care and metta as ways to work with what we call hatred. From the Buddha, anger, confusion, and dishonesty arise when things are set in pairs as opposites. We can also remember the teachings on watching out about getting attached to views, right? Because very commonly, with conflicts, there are attachment to views. We could go into a lot more teachings, but I want to really stop with those, remembering the teachings about reactivity, the nature of dukkha, the teachings about hatred never ending with hatred, the teaching about views. And then I want to identify three inner foundations. Again, see if, as I mentioned these, you can consider maybe how to understand your own difference or conflict and how you might work with it more skillfully. A second foundation, one of the inner foundations, is to look carefully at one's conditioning. How do we look at our own conditioning? You know, for example, for many of us to be conflict avoidant. Know what it is. Know what one's tendencies are when there are differences and conflicts. If I'm conflict avoidant, when there's a difference or a conflict, sometimes even if it's not really involving any hostility, I may freeze. I may want to just get out of there, right? I may just want to, we can look at our conditioning when differences or conflicts arise. Or do I have the conditioning to be just to jump into conflicts and sort of act out? That can be a conditioning. In both cases, there is a lack of mindfulness, a lack of using wisdom. We're just acting. In the one case, we're being avoidant, we're sometimes freezing or just getting out of a situation. The other one, we might just jump in with plenty of reactivity. Right. A third foundation, which we could focus on for quite a while, but it's very familiar to us in terms of practice. A third form of practice, a second inner practice, is to work with the emotions that come up, work with the emotions, the difficult thoughts, the narratives, the being judgmental, the anger, the irritation, maybe the sadness, to work with those so we're not, as it were, controlled by those emotions. And this is, of course, one of the glories of our practice, that we can be skillful when difficult states of mind or body or heart come up. We can work with these. We can work with these with being mindful of the difficult emotions. Fourth foundation that I'll mention, that it's good to mention here, I can bring in the heart practices, compassion or metta or forgiveness. What I have found in working with people, particularly when I teach on transforming the judgmental mind, is that the heart practices, which are most valuable when there's interpersonal difficulty or conflict, are compassion and forgiveness. They're actually more helpful, typically, than metta, because they remind us, usually, that there's pain in the situation. And our hearts, which may have been closed by the difference or conflict, open up with knowing that, oh, this is painful, yes. When we're judgmental, our hearts are not open. They close down. We don't have that open heart. And so I'm being brief with these. The three inner foundations look at our conditioning over time, work with the difficult emotions or thoughts or body states, and then thirdly, bring in the heart practices. And then I want to identify six more outer practices. And maybe we don't do all of these. We might do two or three of them, but it can be helpful to have this perspective. And maybe at a given time we primarily do inner practice. But it's also helpful to know that there can be orientation more at the relational nature. If our conflict is more relational, or if we're trying to deal with a social conflict. And I was thinking in terms of teachings, the fifth foundation is ground in core teachings. And I'll mention a few. One of them is really the teaching that all of us, essentially, to use more Mahayana language, have Buddha nature. Can we remember in a conflict that everyone's deep nature is to be awake, and that our heritage is that we are beings capable of awakening, that our deep nature is awakening. Our deep nature is wisdom, our deep nature is love. This is who we are. And stuff which comes up maybe in a conflict is relatively more superficial. Can we remember that during a conflict? Another way to say it, maybe in the spirit of metta, is that we want to ultimately bring metta to all beings, not just to my inner circle, or not just to people I get on well with, right? That's our horizon. Can we remember that? Another way of saying is that everyone's life matters just as much as mine. That's not easy to remember, is it? And so we can remember these teachings. That's the fifth foundation. And as I was doing this, I was thinking, Uh-oh, Donald, you have another potential book. 10 Foundations. Good book, good structure, good number, you know? But I'm trying to finish my book on transforming the judgmental mind, and I'd really be judgmental if I had something else get in the way. So, anyway, little footnote there. Okay. Related to what I've just named in terms of all of us being beings of awakening, or having what in Mahayana tradition is called bodhicitta, really the mind and heart of awakening. All of us have that. Related to that is developing a vision for conflicts in which our goal with every conflict is to meet all the important interests or needs, the deep needs, whether it's an inner conflict, you know, it's to really recognize what the underlying values are on either side. With a relational conflict, it's to have a vision of meeting the needs of everyone concerned, meeting the deep interests of everyone concerned. Can I go into a difference or conflict with that intention? Dr. Martin Luther King talked about this as the goal of the beloved community. The goal of all his work with differences and conflicts was to come to the beloved community where everyone is in connection, everyone matters. In the field of conflict transformation, this has been expressed as the win-win model of working with conflicts. That our goal in a conflict is to meet the interests and deep needs of everyone. How can we do that? Can we, and mediators, have that in mind? Again, I think it's very similar to, you know, the vision coming from metta, coming from understanding of bodhicitta. Everyone, can we bring that spiritual intention into differences and conflicts? Not always so easy. What we want to do is to move away from our sense of being in a conflict and thinking that, oh, I gotta win. I have to win this argument. I have to get my way. Not easy, right? So obviously we're dealing here with looking at assumptions and structures and attachment to self, right? That becomes an important part of this. So you can see that working with conflicts can be a very, very dynamic form of practice in which we see so much of our stuff, right? We see so much, and we see structures of self, we see attachment to views, we see our own patterns of reactivity. We see all these different dimensions. The seventh foundation is related, it's grounding in ethics. Grounding in the ethics of non-harming. That when we act in the midst of differences or conflicts, we ground ourselves in ethics and non-harming. Not taking that which is not given and care towards others. What I found really useful, for example, in an organization, it can be really, really helpful to have guidelines expressing non-harming for how we'll be when conflicts arise, which they will. Can we have guidelines which give us some direction? When I've worked with groups and programs, one of the first things we've done is we've developed guidelines that express our practice. And that we agree to them within the functioning of the groups, within the functioning of an organization. It could be a guideline like treating everyone with respect, or it could be an expression that everyone's needs matter, everyone's interests matters, something like that. Or to take differences and conflicts as an opportunity for learning. What is sometimes called a fog moment. Do you know that phrase? Do you know what a fog moment is? How many people don't know what a fog moment is? I've heard that this is now part of teaching for people studying social work. A fog moment is an effing opportunity for growth. An effing opportunity. I won't be explicit. Do you know what an effing opportunity for growth is? Everyone know? Right. Okay. That's a fog moment. So that might be a guideline. Take this as a fog moment. We can have that as an agreement in our relationships that we will do that. So I could say a lot more. That's the seventh. And I'll say a little bit more about that because when conflicts are on a larger scale, a social conflict or an international conflict, the ethical grounding translates into a commitment to nonviolence. An understanding that violence resolves nothing. So the eighth foundation is that of empathy, which is a really, really crucial dimension. And we've looked at it here. I teach it often in the context of wise speech practice. This is the ability to tune in to another person's experience. And I think we've explored a number of times, what I call empathy practice as a deliberate intention to tune in to another's emotions and to another's deep needs. And I define a deep need using the approach of nonviolent communication, that the need is something always valuable or valid and relates to something universal, like, and it's distinguished from the strategy, which can be very often very unskillful. So the alcoholic has a deep need for peace, which is valid, and the strategy may be very, very unskillful. Or even in a lot of people who may be on an international level committing violence, that may be a deeply unskillful strategy, but the need that's genuine is for security or for justice or for freedom. And so making that distinction and learning to be empathic towards the genuine deep need, distinguished from the strategy and the emotion, is a really fundamental part of our practice. Can I have empathy towards the person with whom I have a difference? What matters? You know? And I remember, I think I probably have told this story, but I don't remember when the last time was. About 20 years ago, I was part of an interfaith retreat at Los Alamos National Laboratory. And we had lunch every day with the scientists and technicians who were making nuclear weapons. And my intention in those discussions was to bring empathy to our lunchtime discussions. And so I could talk with them. I could really disagree about the strategy of nuclear weapons, but I could hear them talking about values like security, which I could agree with and see as important. So empathy is the eighth foundation, really, really crucial. And I think deeply, deeply crucial to our whole society and our culture. Jeremy Rifkin wrote a book called The Empathic Civilization and said that empathy is the key to solving our most intractable, seemingly systems issues. The ninth foundation is skillful speech. Again, we could go into more depth here, but this is bringing our speech to be truthful. These are the Buddha's guidelines for skillful speech: being truthful, being helpful, coming out of a warm heart, and having good timing and having a sense of that the speech is appropriate. Speaking at the right time, really crucial, particularly in a conflict. Can we bring skillful speech? Can I be present during my speaking? Can I really commit to wise speech, which in the Buddha's teaching actually is part of ethics, but I'm distinguishing it as a separate foundation. That's the ninth foundation. And then the 10th foundation refers to what I talked about earlier. This is at larger levels, maybe where there's a social issue in the community or society or internationally, committing to nonviolent action and committing to that vision of the beloved community and the win-win solution, bringing all of that into the larger situation. This is from Dr. King. The end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. It is this type of spirit and this type of love that can transform opposers into friends. And I believe that that is the model for every conflict, including what's seems very hard, Israel-Palestine. I'll close just with a few quotations. One of them comes from a friend who is a Buddhist teacher in Israel. And she tells me what she's been doing in the last weeks. She says, as well as supporting the Israeli Sangha, we are going into the West Bank almost daily to support our beloved Palestinian friends in the olive harvest. We are joined by a few Israeli friends every day. It is not much, but it makes a difference. It is easier to hold all this tragedy together and to nourish in each other and in the world our strong commitment to a better world. Finding in small ways how to do that. And then from Johan Galtung, a Norwegian peacemaker who I studied with fairly extensively about conflict, he says, in a culture of peace, a culture of peaceful conflict transformation is a key component. And maybe I'll finish with a Palestinian nonviolent activist named Ali Abu Awad. He says, we should not allow our pain to blind us to what is most needed. Mutually guaranteed sovereignty, security, and dignity for both Israelis and Palestinians. Nonviolence is the art of our humanity, and I know how hard it is these days to practice that humanity with the ever-increasing number of victims. I also know that nonviolent activism is the only path to a solution, and it gives purpose and meaning to our daily lives. So I'll stop there and invite a few moments of silence and see what resonates with you. Maybe think about how you may have applied those 10 foundations to your own conflict and see also whatever questions or sharing wants to arise. Take about a minute now. So please, let's open it up. You can either use the raised hand function, or if you want to share something, ask a question, ask for clarification of one of the foundations, whatever. You can raise your hand. I can see everyone if you have your video on. So please, Sheree, yeah.
This is really great, Donald. Thank you. And I hope you do a retreat on this soon because I want to sign up. It's so needed. I have a little confusion here. I just feel a little barb when I look at the conditioning.
Yeah.
So if you, I'm one of those that was conditioned to jump in.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of reactivity, and it definitely causes me a lot of harm and doesn't really help the situation when
Yeah.
that happens, right? But the other extreme is I'll just avoid it completely, right?
Right.
So how do you find that middle ground when one person in the conflict is avoidant and the other one is jump in? How do you find like a workable area?
Great question. And I should say that I've agreed to teach a retreat on this topic at Southern Dharma. Now, for most of the Sangha here, that's in North Carolina, but there'll be a retreat in June, beginning of June, in North Carolina on the topic. You know, which probably about two-thirds silent practice. In terms of your question, unless people can shift from one person being avoidant and one person being indulgent, so to speak, it's very, very hard. In fact, I was thinking of the work of the well-known couples therapist. I'm blanking on his name. What's the name of the famous couples therapist? Anyone know who I'm talking about?
Dr. Phil?
No, it's someone who's written a book. Anyway, his...
Gottman, something like that, with an
Gottman?
H.
Is it Gottman?
No.
Gottman, yeah, that's right. John Gottman.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah, I think it was John. Anyway, Gottman said that he could watch a couple interact around a conflict, and in 5 minutes, he could tell the likelihood that they would be together in 3 years based on how, whether based on their conflict style. And basically, if they had different conflict styles, it'd be very hard. If they had the same conflict style, both were avoidant or both were indulgent, the relationship had better chance of working. And so it's quite difficult when there are these different styles. And something has to give. People have to be willing to learn or work with them. And again, I want to stress something. I didn't stress as much as I wanted to in the talk, that the way that we learn about this is exploring all of this with easy stuff or relatively easy stuff. And then we work up to the hard stuff. Don't start with the hard stuff, right? Work with the easier material and easier so-called conflict that we might not even see as a conflict. We might just see it as a difference. And so if it depends on the relationship, Sheree, if you have a close relationship with someone, maybe you could find a way, maybe starting with something easy to approach things a little differently. If it's a family relationship or something, start with something really easy, and see if you can work there and kind of build some history. That's probably what I would suggest when there are different styles like that, where it's not so threatening and where the conditioning maybe is a little more flexible. That's what occurs to me. Yeah. Thank you. Liz, please.
Hi, thank you. This is a very important topic. I have found recently, in the last couple of years, that empathy for the needs of others has been a radical shift in my functioning.
Beautiful, yeah.
Really important. And also, this is something I've mentioned to you before that I don't think you mention very often, but I could be wrong. Renunciation. For instance, in Israel-Palestine, there has to be some renunciation in terms of power and land. And a lot of times in my conflicts, there's a conflict about who has power. And there needs to be renunciation is a concept that I'm really thinking about. Giving up some area of my power so that we can meet and satisfy the needs.
Really, really good points, Liz. Empathy really, really crucial. And I think it's actually, this is where the empathy practice and the distinction between strategies and the deeper interests or needs is really, really crucial.
Yes.
I'm not going to go into detail on Israel-Palestine, but I would see that the deep needs are for sovereignty, freedom, security, justice, and that certain kinds of power may get in the way of actually, obviously do in this case and many other cases, the power dynamics get in the way of meeting the needs of all, right? So they're clearly, and again, my encouragement would be to think about way, way simpler situations first and sort of training with conflict, but that, yeah, it's really, really crucial to see that one has to, I would frame it partly as giving up some of the strategies and distinguishing those from the deep interests or the deep needs. And sometimes that's going to mean giving up a level of power. One thing I learned from Galtung and when I studied with him was that he said if one is a mediator, and this could really be the case for all sorts of conflicts, as a mediator, one wants to look carefully at the power dynamics. And the goal of a mediator in what's occurring is as much as possible, reduce the influence of the differentials of power as much as possible within the looking at what matters most deeply, as it were. If you think of two people or two sides, what matters most? So the power differential is something that can and typically does can really get in the way. And what one needs to do is to find ways to minimize that or reduce it or end it in some way. And of course, that can be tricky. But I think you're right, really point to power issues is really, really significant in conflicts, along with the importance of empathy and being willing to have some renunciation, I would say, in relationship to past strategies which haven't worked. Thank you. Yeah, please, Vita, please.
Somewhere at the beginning, I heard, doesn't mean you said it, but I heard that this could be just an internal process as well.
Yeah.
So I have, every time I talk to my sister, I just rile.
Yeah.
And this is really very helpful. She doesn't even have to be involved. I mean, it's such an inner, my conflict is, it's an inner conflict with my sister,
Yeah.
and she doesn't have to participate in the healing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does.
That's really valuable, really valuable. Thank you.
Yeah,
And I
no.
just spoke.
Yeah. Thanks, Vita. There are a lot of important points in what you say. That one of them is that I would say in some ways this is a relational conflict, but it's really manifesting in your inner experience. There may not be much happening relationally, but and that it's manifesting in your inner experience, and that you can do tremendous work without even her being involved. That this is where we bring in those inner foundations. There can be one can have a conflict, and you can have what would be the phrase the equivalent of unilateral disarmament or unilateral work with the conflict. Even when your sister may not be doing anything, you can do your inner work, bringing in all these foundations, using the tools you have, and you might come to a very, very different place, which would manifest when you get together, even without your sister doing anything or changing at all, right? And so that's really, that's a crucial point, right? That, and sometimes the situation is that that's the best thing to do, right? Or that's the optimal course of action with a difficult interpersonal or even organizational situation where it's not in the cards to really be interacting. I can still do all my inner work. And that kind of is a little bit counterintuitive, or can be, but that's really an important option to think about. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for bringing that out. Yeah, please, Zoe.
Sorry, I had to unmute. So I was thinking about the organizational kind of conflict, because I work in an organization in which I have to interact with a lot of different people on a daily basis, and there are some conflicts that I perceive that may or not be perceived on both sides, but I have to deal with people that are sometimes not on the same wavelength that I am. And our strategies are often coming from different directions. And in an organization that doesn't seem to value working things out, or sort of conflict resolution, or valuing people's personal needs in a certain sense, you're just a cog in the wheel. And so I was thinking about, sometimes for me, there's a lack of clarity because you don't get to dialogue and work things out with the person on the other side. And you have so many different relationships, and there's different levels of difficulty dealing with different people because you don't have that opportunity. It's not valued, and it's almost forbidden to actually discuss anything that's conflictual, or where you're asking for someone to do something a different way. And so a lot of it is just kind of trying to deal with things and process them and manage, you know, a multitude of different kinds of interactions that aren't necessarily feeling very personally satisfying or professionally satisfying continuously. And the conflict is just how to feel okay, I think, you know, internally, when you're dealing with a lot of that. And so I don't know what else, if you could speak to on that. Is it just doing the, you said not so much the meta, but more of the heart work?
Yeah, I think it's, there are different dimensions to this. How many people can relate to that, either are in or have been in an organization where there's not so much emphasis, or no emphasis on skillful ways of working with conflict or working things out and so forth? So very widespread, right? And it's, that means most likely the organization in certain ways is going to be dysfunctional in certain aspects, right? And not really meeting the needs of people. So a few different levels you could work with. One level would be similar to what Vita brought up, which would just be to see, either for yourself or maybe a small group of people within the organization who share your perspective, to see it primarily about inner work, right? That's one option, you know, so you can make your commitment to living skillfully as possible with conflict, even if others are not, right? And not that satisfying. I've sometimes thought that I've used a model sometimes for, you know, just imagining five options when there are just two people involved in the conflict. And this can be sort of brought out further with the organization. Option number one, I do my own inner work with conflicts. Option number two, I practice skillful speech and interact skillfully, ethically, etc. Option number three, the other person does inner work. Option number four, the other person practices skillful speech, ethics, and so forth. Number five, option number five, we collaborate together and work together. Sometimes only two options are possible. Which are those two options? Well, I think you know, it's number one and two, right? So I, no matter what happens, I can always do my own inner work and always interact as skillfully as happening, no matter what the organizational culture is like. So that's one option. Another one would be to actually see if you can actually work maybe in small ways or larger ways towards a healthier organizational culture. Sometimes there may be some opening, maybe in small ways, to having a few guidelines for what you do, for how you work with each other or treat each other. You know, I've been part of organizations that were not so functional, where I helped bring in guidelines that everyone eventually adopted, including wise speech guidelines. So you may want to see if there's some room to do that. You know, or maybe you find a group of a few people who have similar views and you agree to do that with each other, something like that. So those are a few options, you know, and again, ideally, there could be some way of having guidelines and agreements. But again, I'm hearing that it sounds like a more hierarchical work situation. You know, hierarchical. And so, you know, this is really also almost like a political dimension working towards a more democratic workspace. You know, not easy, but, you know, mm-hmm. where people's deeper interests are valued. But so those are a few thoughts there.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up, Zoe. So I think we're at time now. And, yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for being with this area. I thought the questions were all really bringing out crucial dimensions of doing this. And how many people would like to look at this in your life in the next week and then sort of come back and share what you've explored? I want to encourage that. And again, remembering that we especially learn where the conflicts aren't too difficult, where they're workable, where they're small, where they might be inner conflicts or ones that we might not even think of as conflicts, just a difference. What should I do this evening? You know, should I do this or that or something? You know, and so let me encourage that. And even right now, we'll go to the meta in just a moment, but set your intention for how you'll work with this in the next week. How will I bring this material into my daily life? You know, how will I remember? Take a minute or so.